Good evening. I'm Tony Ner. I'm a trustee of the New York Society Library. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this event tonight. As we begin, may I remind you to silence all cell phones or any other disruptive device, whatever you consider a disruptive device to be. We're honored to have with us this evening the distinguished novelist and the longtime library member, Louis Begley. Born in Poland, he had a harrowing escape into safety, arriving in New York in 1948 at the age of 15, and quickly becoming acclimated to the United States, graduating from Harvard College and Harvard Law School. He was a partner at Debevoise & Plimpton for many years in Paris and in New York, and as time went on, became a superb and marvelously productive author. His first major novel was The Remarkable Wartime Lies, published in 1991, to critical acclaim and winner of the Penn Ernest Hemingway Foundation Award for a first work of fiction and the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, among many others. I think that book is one of the few truly important books about World War II, with an extraordinary narrative momentum and a sophisticated treatment about truth in horrendous circumstances. More recently, Louis has written a series of books about Albert Schmitt, the button-down lawyer who stumbles in his elder years into surprising life and loves. The first book in the series about Schmitt inspired an award-winning film with Jack Nicholson, directed by Alexander Payne. The new volume, Schmitt Steps Back, is just out. Ron Carlson, I think, put it well in the New York Times when he wrote, "Schmitt, as he considers, worries, wonders, speculates, calculates, plans, and reconsiders, is engaging company." One of the victories in this novel is how candid he is. Begley gets as close to Schmitt as a diarist, inhabiting this man who has been seasoned by a long life and yet somehow seems new this morning. Schmitt can cavil with the best of them, but he has a code. He's capable of a sombering empathy, has a withering understanding of the recent Bush regime, knows how to prepare a martini. We get so close to him in this intimately written book. Two biographical specifics. Two of Louis's three children are authors. His son Adam is presently writing a biography of John Updike, and his daughter Amy is a very prolific novelist. And his son, Peter, is a superb painter. And I understand from a colleague that Louis's wife, Anke Milstein, who is here this evening, a distinguished author in her own right, whose latest book is The Delightful Balzac's Omelette, was a great success the other evening at the Athenaeum in Boston. Please join me in welcoming Louis Begley.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to do some housekeeping here, like finding out whether you can hear me. Yes, good. Thank you, Tony, for this very generous and heartwarming introduction. Thank you, Sarah Holliday, you're somewhere there. Thank you, Mr. Bartlett. Thank you, New York Society Library. We live just around the corner, as it were, and while I am not a great user of the library because I'm not a nonfiction writer. I don't know whether my wife would have remained with me all these years if we hadn't had New York Society Library sort of within the reach of her hand. So I'm particularly glad to be here. Now, Tony said something about Albert Schmitt, who is known to his friends as Schmitty. And I think I'll tell you a little more. Schmitty is indeed, I say is because he still lives, is indeed a New York lawyer who retired early from a firm which I guess detractors would call a white shoe law firm. He retired in the beginning of the 90s early because his wife was dying of what one may assume was cancer. and he sold his apartment on Fifth Avenue, moved to Bridgehampton, where he and his wife, which is in eastern Long Island, where he and his wife had a house they inherited from a maiden aunt. Schmidt is grief-stricken and absolutely at loose ends after the death of his wife. He has one daughter with Charlotte, with whom he has a tenuous and very rocky relationship. He is appalled by her forthcoming marriage to one of his young partners. He doesn't think this is a suitable marriage for a number of reasons. One of those reasons being that the young man is Jewish. Now, Schmidt actually helped him, was instrumental in this young man's becoming a partner. But in his book, though qualified to be his partner, he was not necessarily qualified to be his son-in-law. And that gets the relationship with Charlotte into a deeper rut than it might have otherwise been in. Now, people have asked me often why I, a Jew who, as Tony pointed out, managed to escape the Holocaust, why not call it that, in Poland, have a somewhat anti-Semitic protagonist to whom I'm very close. The reason is that I write in the realist tradition, and it's really impossible to write about people of Tony's and my age in East Coast, on the East Coast, in these great law firms and investment banks, without showing the ugly side of American society at that time. That was a period when it was easier for a camel to go through the needle of an eye than for a Jew to buy an apartment in a good building on Park Avenue or on Fifth Avenue. So the tinge of anti-Semitism is a necessary piece of Schmidt's equipment. It's one of these things that doesn't go very far. For instance, he does help his son-in-law, John Riker, to become a partner in his firm. His very best friend, like the closest person to him, a man called Gil Blackman, whom you will encounter, a mention of him in the passage I will read as a Jew. The woman with whom Schmidt falls in love with in this new book, Schmidt Steps Back, happens to be half Jewish, which surprises Schmidt when she mentions it casually, and he sort of has taken aback slightly. But why? He's taken aback because she's French. And so there were none of the warning signs that he might have recognized if she were American, but it does not make him love her any the less. Now, Schmidt is consoled, if that one may use that word, after his wife's death by a love affair with a 20-year-old, therefore 40 years younger, absolutely gorgeous waitress in Bridgehampton. And that affair takes up most of about Schmidt, let's say most of Schmidt's emotional life that is not tangled up with his daughter, of about Schmidt and the second Schmidt novel, which is Schmidt Delivered. And indeed, she is the most marvelous creation, my beautiful Carrie. I think of her as Hecate, a two-faced goddess, absolutely marvelous. By the time Schmidt Steps Back begins, Carrie is married to a young man who used to be the chief of security for Schmidt's marvelous friend, Mike Mansour, a Jewish Egyptian American billionaire who appeared on the scene in Schmidt Delivered, and it takes up more and more sort of room in the novel. And Schmidt continues to shower benefactions on the young couple. The young woman, Carrie, is pregnant. It is not clear at the beginning of the book, but it does become clear at the end, whether the child indeed is Schmidt's or the young man's. You will find, we find at the beginning of the of Schmidt Steps Back, that Schmidt has fallen in love head over heels with the widow of a young partner of his who was the head of Schmidt's law firm's Paris office. And she is only 15 years younger than he. It's a much, or 13 perhaps. It's a much more suitable, perhaps, distance between the two of them. And curiously enough, she returns his affection very rapidly. And things seem to be going very well. Schmidt is the marrying kind. He tried to marry Carrie, the 20-year-old waitress, who thought he was crazy. And he is trying to marry Alice, this marvelous, marvelous French woman. And Alice seems curiously recalcitrant. In Schmidt Steps Back, the relations between Schmidt and his daughter Charlotte and the dreaded mother-in-law, Renata Riker, a psychiatrist, and her husband, much milder and much nicer, Myron Riker, have deteriorated to a point at which they're barely sustainable. Why do I hate the Rikers so? Well, because they're hateful. And I began by disliking them mildly, but I now loathe them. But I don't know if they will reappear in Schmidt 4, but I can't imagine disliking them any more than I dislike them now. Now, let's see. What else do you need to know? I've told you that there is the marvelous Mr. Mansour, and I told you about Gil Blackman. Little Albert is the yet unborn child of Carrie and this fellow Jason, but they've asked permission to name him Albert, so that would be a reference to him. And in the scene I will read to you, Schmidt has lunch in Paris with Alice and a man called Sergei Popov, who is a Bulgarian, who was a classmate of Schmidt's at Harvard College. Schmidt disliked him intensely at Harvard College. And why is he having lunch with him? Because Alice asked him to. Popov is a colleague of hers at a publishing house in Paris where she is working. If I've forgotten to give you essential information, I will stop as I read and bring you up to date. So here we go. Salve Schmitty, a man who had to be Popov, since he was rising from a table where he had been sitting with Alice, stepped forward and extended his arms to embrace Schmidt. How long has it been since our freshman year? 45 years? You haven't changed, you old thief. The same red hair and the same sourpuss expression. Caught in a bear hug, accompanied by a Slavic-sounding grunt, but ducking the proffer of Popov's cheeks or lips, however Popov's gesture was to be interpreted, Schmidt kissed Alice on her cheeks, sat down, and examined his host. He was thinner and more stooped. His hair, once a brilliantine smeared brown, had gone gray and wispy, but the shiny double-breasted black suit, which in Schmidt's opinion cried out for the services of a dry cleaner, was a replica of the one that Popov had worn day in and day out as an undergraduate. None of this was surprising. Schmidt imagined Popov's glee at taking stock of what changes the years had wrought in him, assuming that Popov bothered to look and remembered. having ordered lunch, Popov emptied his glass of wine, refilled it, and addressed to Alice a rapid stream of anecdotes, interrupted only by his chortles over the authors he had accompanied on the book tour just concluded and the variety of literary and publishing figures to whom he referred by first name only. Schmidt didn't mind being left out of the conversation. It was not unlike the old days chatter among Mary, she was an editor, and her editor and agent friends. Presumably Alice hadn't seen Popov since his return the previous day, and absorbed by what Popov had to say, didn't attempt to draw Schmidt in. That too was all right with Schmidt. Being allowed to eat his leek salad in peace was better than what he had expected. However, as soon as his smoked haddock had been served, the respite ended. Popov turned for the first time in his direction and announced, "You have become a powerful philanthropist, quite a step up for a lawyer." It wasn't clear to Schmidt how this observation, which he found offensive, was meant to be taken. Never mind, he was not going to rise to the bait. "I'm not very powerful," he replied, "just lucky that my country neighbor, Michael Mansour, has recently decided to give me a job. You may not know it, but I retired from the practice of law just about 3 years ago after my wife died." "Such a loss," cried Popov. "That splendid Mary Ryan, that was her name at Radcliffe, her maiden name, Mary Ryan. Lois Witherspoon, Mary Ryan, and Ginny Burpink, three roommates, each more beautiful and intelligent than the other. I bet you didn't know that I was close to them, Schmitty. They were 3 years behind us in college, but I took them out. I've always liked younger women." Here he looked at Alex and punched her playfully on the arm. "I don't think you knew Mary at college," continued Popov, "but I got to know her well. You, my friend Gil Blackman, my roommate Kevin, all of you left after graduation, but I stayed on doing graduate work. When I went into publishing a number of years later, Mary and I reconnected, of course. What a powerhouse she was. Nobody in American publishing measured up to her." "That's what I've always heard," replied Schmidt. He felt the stirring of a better feeling toward Popov. It was good to have him praise Mary in Alice's hearing. "Ach, yes, and what good times we would have at the Frankfurt Book Fair." Popov rolled his eyes and smacked his lips. After a short silence, he spoke again. "I had a special reason for asking Alice to bring us together. It's your neighbor and employer, Mr. Mansour. A group of us in publishing think this is the right time to establish a prestigious and important annual prize to honor the best work of fiction and the best work of poetry written in Arabic. The jury would be of very high quality. We think that given his Middle Eastern background, Mr. Mansour might be open to such a project and that you would be the right person to present it to him." Was that the reason for this lunch? Schmidt asked himself. If it was, and if Popov and his friends had done nothing so far about approaching Mike, they must believe in the power of wishful thinking. What else would have brought about this fortuitous meeting between him and Schmidt, who had just happened to have a connection to Mike, and Alice, who was Popov's colleague? "It's not impossible that he would be interested," Schmidt said. "He does read a good deal, even if it isn't belles lettres. If you have a proposal, you should send it to his advisor, Bruce Holbein, at Mansour Industries' main office. Since this is outside the scope of the foundation's work, Mike would in any event give it to him and not me to review before he looked at it himself. I'd be glad to mention to both of them that you have spoken to me. This is very good of you, Popov said. I have another request, or maybe a question. Alice has told me about the foundation offices you have been visiting. Why isn't there one in Sofia? In Bulgaria. You may not know it, but I have an important connection with Bulgaria, and I consider the omission a slight. Schmidt raised his eyebrows. One of the reasons, he answered, is the level of corruption in Bulgaria. The foundation doesn't itself operate schools or think tanks or universities. It gives money to existing institutions and works with them, gives advice, finances visits by scholars and political leaders from other countries, and visits by local political leaders or potential political leaders to the United States. Sometimes it organizes seminars and lectures. We fear that any money we give to practically any institution in Bulgaria would be at high risk of being stolen. I resent that, Popov raised his voice. You asked the question, said Schmidt, so I'm giving you the answer. Popov glowered at him. You think it's worse than in Romania or Hungary, where you do have offices? It's a matter of degree, but yes, we've been advised it's much worse. I resent that, Popov repeated. Schmidt noticed Alice's hand on Popov's sleeve. If this was meant to restrain him, she didn't succeed. You may be ignorant of my personal saga, Popov continued. All I know is that you were born in Bulgaria and at some point during the war or later became a refugee, a displaced person of sorts. You are very ignorant, Popov declared. My father was the last minister of justice serving Tsar Boris III, the heroic ruler murdered by the Germans because he wouldn't let them send his Bulgarian Jews to Auschwitz. My father's father was, until he died, His Majesty's court chamberlain. My grandfather died of old age in his own bed in his own palace, but my father was murdered by the communists along with the Tsar's brother, Prince Kirill, and other members of the Regency Council and other high patriots. I had the good fortune to be taken into exile by Her Majesty the Tsarina. My education at boarding school and Harvard was graciously paid for from her imperial purse. I am on terms of personal friendship with Tsar Simon II. He is younger than I, but we have known each other since early childhood. I find your discrimination against my country of birth intolerable. He sank into gloom and took on a superior expression that reminded Schmidt of the occasions, fortunately infrequent, when Popov would unexpectedly appear at the suite that Schmidt and Gil Blackman shared at college and jump into whatever discussion of politics or modern European history happened to be taking place. The accent when he spoke English had remained almost the same, an element in it of something unidentifiably Slavic. And now that he lived in France and presumably spoke French much of the time and a mixture of something Gaelic. The gurgling that accompanied the flights of eloquence or hilarity hadn't changed either. That is very grand and, of course, a very sad story, replied Schmidt. I can only hope that your Bulgarian connections make it possible for you to help bring better government to your country, now that it's no longer under communist rule. There is more of my story that you don't know, or you would not be suggesting so blithely that I immerse myself in Bulgarian politics. That had been my hope at college and graduate school, and also when I became the editor of Currents. I don't suppose you were a reader of the journal. Schmidt confirmed that unfortunately he wasn't. I'm not surprised. Then you don't know the defining effect of that seminal journal on political thought in intellectual milieus in the United States and Western Europe. But not long after I assumed the direction of the journal, I met my wife. She is a member of one of France's great noble families. It was out of the question that she settle in the United States, where Current was obliged to return because of funding considerations. She found the Philistine and petty bourgeois mentality of 99% of your countrymen intolerable. A form of mentality, I am forced to add, that I too could tolerate less and less. So it happened that I entered the world of publishing in France, where now you find me. We were, alas, soon brought low by fate in a way that further reduced my availability for service to my country. My wife was among the last victims of a polio epidemic. Tanny Leclerc was stricken in 1956, my Solange even later in 1959, soon after the birth of our second boy. Paralyzed from the waist down. I'm deeply sorry, said Schmidt. Popov made a snorting noise. Yes, of course. Now that we have disagreed about Bulgaria and you have seen how you have misjudged my position, you will be hostile to the proposal for the Middle Eastern Literary Prize. Far from it, said Schmidt. There are persistent themes in history, Popov continued. History of men and of nations. Resentments play their role. Wilhelm II, Churchill, de Gaulle. I too have been accustomed to being resented. At school and then at college. Don't try to deny it. I carried my head too high. I was too fully conscious of my real position, so far superior to what it appeared to be. He sank into even deeper gloom. Alice, who had remained silent until then, spoke up. We really must go now. She called the waiter and, to Schmidt's surprise, paid the check. It had been so clearly stated that it was Popov who was inviting Alice and him to lunch that he refrained from protesting. They parted in the street, going in different directions. Schmidt, first to the store on the Rue de l'Université, in the window of which he had seen a layette that might just do as a baby present for little Albert, and then to the shirtmaker on Place Vendôme, where he might buy a necktie or two. For big Albert, he whispered. He had not covered more than a few yards, however, before looking back. He wanted to see Alice once more, even if it was only for a fleeting moment. He did see her. She and Popov were walking fast toward Rue du Bac, with their arms around each other's waists, except that Popov's hand was actually lower. He was patting Alice on her bottom, investigating through her summer dress the valley between her buttocks. Lot's wife looked back on Sodom and was turned into a pillar of salt. Schmidt was spared that fate. But Alice, perhaps sensing his eyes upon her, turned her head in his direction. She raised her eyebrows by way of acknowledgement of his gaze and smiled comically, helplessly. He smiled back, set his teeth, and went on to run his errands. I think that I have just reached the magic moment when I am allowed to stop. Of course, I could go on. I've often thought of reading the entire book. Nothing would give me greater pleasure. Now, I love not to read, and I love to answer questions, if you have any. If you don't, that's all right, too. Yes. Well, you know, I can't tell you. Schmidt came into my mind really fully formed. Not that he's Venus-like, but like Venus, or on the half shell, or Athena when she sprang from Jove's head. And his name was Schmidt. There was no question about it. And so I, actually his name was Albert Schmidt, which is why, since he can't stand the name Albert, and I don't like it either, he is called Schmitty. Mansur also, well, actually I know, I've known a man called Mansur, an Egyptian who had two rows of teeth, rather like a shark. And I gave Mr. Mansur the name Mansur somewhat in an homage to the real Mansur. Yes. What the type of what? He's confusing to you? Well, actually, you see, Popov is essential to the story because Alice has a long-standing liaison with him, which she perhaps foolishly and perhaps wisely hides from Schmidt. Schmidt would have not wanted to share, and she does not want to let go. So Popov had to be there, and Popov is also the name that popped into my head, so I kept it. And Popov was inspired, actually, by a classmate, now dead, who was not Bulgarian. He was some other type of person from the Balkans, somewhere or other. I think probably Serb, but maybe Croat. Anyway, he did not wear a black suit, and he did not have brilliantine hair, but he had a great deal of Popov's pomposity. Yeah. So you know these things are somewhat magical; they just happen. Things that you didn't know you knew, you find out that you do know, and they just come out. Uh-huh. So, well, let me first answer I'll answer the question separately. There is no message. I don't write books with messages. The book tells you exactly what I've written down, and if there is a message, it's the totality of the book. So I can't tell you what you should take away, except I hope a memory that's somehow significant to you. I know significant implies a meaning, but I'm let's say mildly important to you. A memory that's mildly important to you, and that it has entertained you. Now, is it really true that Schmidt has not gained insight? I think he has. I think that if one considers his treatment of Carrie and her husband Jason, and the little boy Albert, and the way he goes about assuring Albert's well-being, education, and so forth, I think with great discretion, shows a certain evolution from the Schmidt whom one met in About Schmidt. I think in his relations with Mike Mansour, He has matured greatly. He now understands the good side of Mansur, which he did not understand when he first met him and Schmidt delivered. I think that he shows a great deal of humanity and, in fact, a kind of angelic patience and perseverance in his attempts to make a go of it with Charlotte. And Charlotte suffers from severe depression, or mild depression, whichever terminology, in this book. And she then recovers and then meets with an accident. Anyway, I think in that relationship, he has shows far greater maturity than he had before, and also in his relationship with John Riker's father, Myron. I disagree with you about that. I think he has become wiser, more tolerant, far more tolerant, far more modest. So I think he has grown, and I think the stepping back is does not in the German translation. I wanted to have a very literal translation of the title, which I thought worked very well, but my German publisher insisted on Schmidt's Einsicht, which means Schmidt's insight. I thought that was pushing it a little bit too far. But I do think that he has more of a perspective on life and on people than he did. Anyway, I've grown to like him even better. Yes, please. Sorry. Well, you know, I think it's complicated. There are actually two separate people sort of nibbling. But I think that, you know, experience proves that nibbles films 99.9% fail. So I don't devote much thought to it. But it's very complicated because Alexander Payne, when he made the movie about Schmidt, used my title. And he used great themes. What is it like no longer to have your profession? You know, Schmidt stops being a lawyer. And what is it like to lose one's wife, around whom one's life was built? What is it like to have a tough relationship with one's only daughter? But he moved Schmidt to Omaha, Nebraska, from Bridgehampton and New York City. And he gave him a new first name, Warren, and he made him an insurance company actuary, and he didn't include in the film my marvelous character Carrie. Jack Nicholson, I'm told, Jack Nicholson loved the book. I'm told that when he read the screenplay and saw no Carrie, he said, "We've just lost $50 million. but anyway, so you see, I would not agree to have my Schmidt, further Schmidt books continued as the further adventures of Warren Schmidt, retired actuary. But so what does one do? I think one could, of course, change the name of the protagonist to Brown and carry on with the story, but perhaps somebody will. Yes, please. Well, I think that he he genuinely loved her, and he genuinely understood that it could not go on, that she had to have her life. In fact, in Schmidt Delivered, when he tries to get her to marry him, he thinks of her having a kind of a good run with him, and then she can go on and have another life with someone else. And he understands that this is right. And as somewhere in this book, he says he still loves her, but it's a kind of paternal love. I think that's a perfectly plausible evolution. I think that gave me no trouble whatsoever in terms of plausibility. And I'm very much concerned with psychological correctness of what I write. The thing that worried me far more in this department was whether it was possible that Alice would forgive him for his rough treatment of her after he finds out about Popov, and that they could come back together. And I think in the end, yes, it's possible. So at least I was secure enough in the thought to go on. I have a feeling that I have absolutely satisfied everybody's curiosity. Thank you very, very much.
The Corner Bookstore is outside, and they're happy to sell you a copy of the new novel. And, of course, Mr. Begley will be happy to sign them at the front. Thank you all for coming. And if you're not a library member, also take away one of our Edith Wharton cards and come back to see the exhibition another day.